This is KDLL, 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. You're tuned in to the Kenai Conversation. I'm Hunter Morrison. On this week's Kenai Conversation, we're joined by Terry Carter, lifelong Soldotna resident and author of the soon-to-be-released book, Whispers of Water. Terry, thanks for joining us.
Hey, I'm so glad to be here, Hunter. Thanks for making it possible.
So, you know, first things first, I kind of would like to get to know you and have our audience get to know you. So introduce yourself.
So I was born in Soldotna. While I didn't choose that, I've made the decision to spend my life here. And it's a community that I just absolutely cherish. So I've been here from its entire development and seen the changes and all that comes with that. Being in a small town for as long as I have just tons of connections and familiar faces, and it's a place that is important. I still have a lot of family here.
Cool. And, yeah. You know, you mentioned, growing up here. What was that sort of experience like?
So that's one of the things I address in the book. That's one of the things, actually, that the people who have got copies of an early release have been most moved by is the account and the capture of that early life here. So my family came to Alaska really early on. My mom came in the 30s with the colonization project in Palmer, Alaska. She was one of the colonists there. And my dad was in World War II at a crazy early age, but at the end of the war was sent to Alaska. Those two had actually homesteaded in Kinnick, but fished the river at some point. And as a result of that, once the road was in, we were down a lot. And by 1960, we were living here. So when I showed up, there were about 400 people. And we lived in just a little house, a little cabin that we built on the edge of the river, living a super subsistence lifestyle of the salmon that we caught and the moose that we killed, the garden that we grew. There were a few little businesses scattered along the road, but Soldotna was just a collection of homesteads. So it was really rural. The towns were, we had schools, but they were little. There was one bus for the entire K Beach route for, first grade. There wasn't a kindergarten, first grade through high school. So it's just a tiny little community. It's interesting that so many people that hear about that type of lifestyle, burning wood, hauling water, no electricity, no phones, it's hard to relate to. Some people opt to live off the grid, but few of us lived at a time when there wasn't a grid to opt into. And it's just an unusual lifestyle, again, that's there's still a lot of people here who lived that way, but a lot of young people will say it sounds like a Discovery Special or an excerpt from the 1800s, but it was a good way to grow up. A lot of hard work, a lot of close community, a lot of connection.
And, you know, did that sort of way of life instill maybe an early appreciation for the land here itself?
We were really dependent on the land, especially the river. So we lived literally right on the banks of the river. And as children, we were turned loose to follow its paths up and down. We were absolutely acquainted with all the different types of wildlife. But the river was always the center of attention and the main focus, because all of the wildlife was there because of the river as well. Early in our lives, there were very few boats on the river. If there was a boat on the river, and we could hear it coming forever, and they usually stopped at our house for a cup of coffee. There was a lot of commercial fishermen, but there were very few people that were sports fishing or attempting to catch fish from the river. And that was how we acquired our food source. So that was a constant endeavor and just a really important part of recreation. But I was especially connected to the river. It was beautiful and tranquil, and all of my major life's events have taken place on that river. So it's it just echoes through my mind and heart in a really powerful way.
And like, what major life events have occurred on the river?
Oh gosh, I was married on that river. So many members of my family have been married there. Just the day-to-day life celebrations of birthdays and family gatherings and reunions still on that river. We recently celebrated 90 years in Alaska. My mother's ashes are sprinkled in that river. It was my father's favorite place. He died when I was young, and that's where I remember him most, is on that river. And it's still where I go to. Just, there's such a tranquility about it, even in the midst of the chaos and the crazy amount of people that are there. There's still just that nostalgia and that connection and that, just the role that it's played throughout time, not just in my life, but in the lives of other people too.
And, you know, one thing that you sort of alluded to was, you know, some of the changes that you've noticed. What are, I guess, you know, just off the top of your head, some of the biggest changes you've noticed on the river since living here?
Well, I mentioned that there were very few people fishing it in any way. So that's probably one of the most dramatic changes. So once it became a major fishing destination, the king salmon were the major trophy fish. And, you know, people from all over the world would flock here to fish all through the 80s. With the change in that and the change in the king, the diminishing runs and diminishing size and, you know, the closing of that fishery, there's an increasing focus on the reds. And now, you know, we have the same kind of explosion. They've kind of taken the place and that trophy fishery, not a trophy fishery maybe, but that sports fishery is just so sought after. And the river probably has a carrying capacity. It's never been determined, but it's surely exceeded on those days in July when you know, all of Anchorage and half of the rest of the world seems to be here and
you know, and competing. Are those changes like addressed in the book?
Yeah, they are. That's a lot of research and a lot of information. A lot of the different components, even some of the politics, is well researched and addressed.
Okay, gotcha. And we'll dive a bit more into the book here in a couple of minutes. But mm-hmm. I'm curious a little bit about your career. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So I have always been mesmerized by children. I absolutely adore children. So I spent my life teaching. Early on, I taught preschool and then had a preschool daycare of my own. And when my youngest son went to kindergarten, I completed my certification for a K-7 certification, and I taught in the area schools for the last 27 years. I retired a few years ago.
And, you know, what subjects did you teach?
I taught it all. I taught first through sixth grades in varying combinations. The last about 17 years I taught in a charter school, in the Montessori charter school, where I had fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, and I had my kids for 3 years, and was able to do things like teach children instead of curriculum and provide a lot of powerful experiences that involved outdoor learning and including the river and the role that it plays in our community and our culture and as part of their sense of place. And
okay, gotcha. And yeah. I kind of want to kind of dive into that. You know, I read in your author statement that you taught, you know, not just in the classrooms, but in forests along the shorelines and besides the river's shifting edge. Could you tell me about that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think that that there's so much to education, and there's a role for the classroom without question, but there's also a need, in my belief, that it be applied. And I think that we're educating future decision makers and people who will grow to be the important members of our community. And the more they know about it, the better off they are. And kids need wild places. So we would, like I said, raft the river. I would take them camping out on the refuge. We would, we did a lot of stream monitoring and stream studies, did forest ecology. We'd spend 3 days across Kachemak Bay doing marine biology and beach ecology. And I know that there are parents and families who are remembering those trips fondly, and just a lot of students through time who, when they come back to visit, and I love it when they do, that's what they remember, are those adventures and those opportunities to experience life in that way and to learn in that context.
And now, you alluded to it just a minute ago, but I guess, you know, more broadly, what would you say is the importance of you know, teaching young people to be sort of stewards of the land?
I think that it's innate in us to take care of what we care about. And to care about something, you need to experience it. You need to see it and experience it, not just in a book or through a video or on a computer, but to be out in it and living it and being cold in it, playing in it, laughing in it, all the things that we do that bring about a deeper and more complete understanding. And then the applied sciences are endless, and the opportunities to for that as well.
Okay, gotcha. Now, before we dive into the book a little bit more, I'm curious about like your writing career. Have you ever written, like, I know this is your first book, but have you written any short stories or poems or anything like that in the past?
Nothing that's been published. Things that I've played around with a bit, but not a ton. I've taught a lot of writing, but I've never seriously written anything until this book. This is the first run at it.
Okay, gotcha. And mm-hmm. Yeah, tell me about the book, Whispers of Water.
So Whispers of Water is just a combination memoir, the stories of my life mixed in with the history of this place, especially the Kenai River and the people through time along the river. It explores the environmental and ecological aspects of all of it. And I just think it's really important that people have an opportunity to better understand this place. So many people are from elsewhere, and they plan to go back either to where they came from or on to their next adventure. And it's the history of this place is really, it's really cool. It's pretty fascinating, but it's really hard to learn, honestly. There's not a consolidated source of that information. I spent a lifetime learning it because I was super intrigued by it. As a little kid, roaming the river, I would see what I learned were village sites. We would find artifacts. And I knew people had been here before, but I couldn't find the information about who they were and where they were now and the details that just, you know, just really charged my imagination. But I knew that they lived in this place, and I knew that we have that in common. And I knew that they would have lived on the river and lived from the salmon that are there and the resources that are available. And so there's a ton of information about the earliest people, the Kachemak Riverine people that were here from 1000 BC to about 900 AD. And then they're replaced then by the Dena'ina people, the current Kenai-Tsi tribe that are still here. There's a chapter on the Russian fur traders that came, the explorers that came, Captain Cook and Vancouver, and all the people who, through maps and muskets, made a huge impact on this place as well. And their time here is pretty intriguing and not that well known. I go into when salmon became currency, when it went from a life source to an income source, and the change with the commercial fishing and that development in the late 1800s to its current state now. And then the development of the little communities as the homesteading that happened, that my family was, while not officially homesteaders, early settlers, and then the development of the communities. But it's all related and connected to the river and the role that the river plays, the impacts that people have had on the river through time and the state of it now. And it's really a love letter to the river in a lot of ways, and a plea for people to stand on its behalf and save what's left.
And for the like historical aspects of the book, how did you sort of research that and, you know, find this information?
Gosh, I said earlier, I was really intrigued by it, so curious about it. Things like one time as a little kid, I was at a cannery and we fished everywhere. We were hooligan fishing at the time, and I had wandered away. And in the woods, I found an old graveyard that had a fence around it and tall pedestals that were tombstones, but that had Chinese writing carved into the wood. And I was so intrigued by that. And it took me years to find somebody who knew that the canning corporations contracted with the Chinese mafia and brought Chinese workers up. There were a lot of Chinese workers at the canneries here. So just living here and finding things that intrigued my curiosity and asking a ton of questions. Probably the biggest thing happened when I took a class at the college called Cook Inland Anthropology with a man named Alan Boris, who's really such a local hero in a lot of ways and has informed so many of us so completely. And that was just a revelation, because that's when I really began to learn about the Kachemak Bay tradition people, those people that were there earlier. And I was able to find then different archaeological records to read and to better understand what is known about them, which is, you know, the archaeological record, the tools and the resources they used, the places that they lived. It was there, too, that I began to really learn more about the Dena'ina, and there, too, found the resources that were recorded and met the people who were the culture bearers of that time and of that culture. So that was really an open door. And I also began to find, like, Russian journals that had been translated. And, you know, just continually out of that genuine curiosity, I spent a lifetime of learning. But as I began to write the book, I had already collected a lot of those resources, but I collected a bunch more. And then while a lot of the information was really familiar, I went through the process of researching to, you know, confirm the accuracy and get the specifics in line and make sure that all of it was, you know, accurately represented and from the multiple sources that I was able to acquire. So it's been a lifelong project in some ways.
Okay, gotcha. And now you mentioned the book talks about, you know, the people through time here in the area, mm-hmm. from the Kachemak Bay people to the Dena'ina to the Russians. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess broadly, what would you say is the importance of just recognizing those folks, these groups of people in the book?
I think so many people have the perspective that this place is unsettled and wild and new and never developed. The history that we have here isn't represented in 200-year-old buildings. It's not found in that type of a record, but it is here, and it's equally as valuable. I think that it's impossible to really understand a place until you understand its place through time and the people who have been here before you, and their legacies and the impact that they've had on this place. Learning how they lived and how they lived with this place is a really valuable perspective that lends just a depth of appreciation and a depth of insight to being here.
And now this book is a tribute to those people and to also, like, just the land in general, but it's also sort of a warning and a call to action. Can you tell me about that a little bit more?
Well, I think that anybody who's loves the river, and so many of us do, see the changes that are happening. There are some of us that have a different perspective. There's something called a shifting baseline. And I actually, it was one of my editors who was reading a chapter and said, "Man, you are talking about shifting baselines here. You should, you know, look further into that." And it's like, so the idea that people from elsewhere come to this place and from their perspective, from where they come from, the rivers that they've lived on or the river they've fished from, when they see the Kenai River and experience, they see it as just wild and unimpacted and completely intact. Because they weren't here in the early 60s when there were very few houses on the river, when there were almost no boats on the river, when the bears fished the main stem of the river, when there were beavers in the river and otters all over the place, when it really was much more of a wild river. But at the same time, if you were to compare my perspective, that early perspective of what I perceived as a completely wild river, if you were to talk to somebody of Kenaitse heritage or Dena'ina heritage that were here much longer, they too would have a different baseline, you know, a different perspective that, you know, this river is changing. So, that consideration is important, because I just I think that people, if they can see what it once was, they can see what it is now. And we have a long history with rivers. In Scotland, 500 years ago, they knew that if you put a dam in a stream, that it would completely destroy the salmon population. They knew it, it's recorded, but they still did it. All over Europe. And all of the European salmon are completely decimated. They are extinct. In the Eastern Seaboard, it was the same story. They began to see that, you know, the things they were doing were impacting the salmon. And while the salmon were important, there's just an arrogance to people. You know, the selfish motivation we have outweighs often, you know, other concerns. So, you know, the condition of Atlantic salmon, I've been in Maine when they're celebrating the return of 3 and 4 fish to the river. And it's, you know, it is a major celebration. They've done amazing things to rehabilitate the rivers, and that's happening is a celebration, but it's also a tragedy. So then there's the Pacific Northwest, where those rivers were far exceeded the types of runs that we have here. The Columbia, the Snake, some of those rivers were, you know, just unprecedented in the amount of salmon and wildlife and the cultures that lived all along them. And now those salmon are all endangered. And it's often those people that come here and see this river as unimpacted because they just continue to move on. So the Kenai River is a river who's just kind of at a turning point. This could be the river that we learn, This could be the river where we all decide that this is more important than my short-term gain. This river and its sustainability and the watershed that protects it is more important than the business that I have directly on it or the income that I can earn from it. Because we've been repeating these same mistakes, and we still are. With the development, with the impact, with the user groups and the pressure and the often infighting and blame that goes on, it's not too late, but it's starting to show, like with the king salmon, they're showing signs of decline, and it doesn't have to be that way. It isn't too late. People can take a stand. So my biggest hope from all of this is that this can provide information and perspective. And even maybe, motivation and insight as to what can be done. And so I do get into that in the book. I think that there's a lot of organizations that are working toward that intentionally. They all may have different, there are some differences to them too, but that overall, I think that I know that there's no one that wants to set out to do harm. There's an important community event that's taking place. It's just starting to be publicized. It's called the Kenai King Initiative. It's a program through the Watershed Forum, and it's working to ask the really hard questions and find the answers that we most need. So on October 25th from 9 to 2, it's going to be held at the prep school in Soldotna. Information can be found at the Watershed Forum website. Increasing information is going to be released community-wide. It's been in the planning stages, and this is intentionally now being released. But it's the intent is that it's a community forum where people who are interested, we know that there are community members that have insight and information and wisdom and perspectives that we can all benefit from. So the intent is that anybody that's interested can come together to have conversations, not only to speak their information, but to hear the other information from others. And from that forum, the top concerns will be identified before the forum's over. Those top concerns will be identified, and there'll be a huge push then to look at what are those top concerns? What is the research that still needs to be done? What are the policies that most need to be changed? And task forces will be formed then to pursue that. So I think there's an increasing recognition that we're hitting a turning point, but there's also increasing motivation and action that's being taken.
And you know, that turning point, and I guess in what other ways can we sort of reach that turning point to maybe focus more on the conservation of the river and mm-hmm. its and the resource itself?
I think I love to walk the river. It just is joyous to me. And just the other day, as I walked along the river, one of the really important things about just the overall health of the river is the riparian zone. And the riparian zone is the section of forest and land that runs right along from the edge of the river back about 100 feet. We have a buffer along this river, a 50-foot buffer, that is intentionally to be undeveloped and to be guarded, and that way is recognized through the borough and varying organizations as a critical zone. That zone is so critical because it's so the substructure of the peninsula is unsorted glacial till, which just means that as the glaciers receded about 10,000 years ago, it left a tumble of silt and sand and rock, and it's not sorted out, it's not stable, it's all mixed in together. So the river cuts through that. And the vegetation that grows along the edge of the river, there's different types of herbaceous, different types of plants. There's grasses and sedges. There's different types of shrubs and willows, but none of them are necessarily very tough. But their role altogether is those root systems hold that fragile soil in place. And as the river cuts through it, that bank then is held up by that vegetation. And there's the soils underneath those root systems kind of wash away. And that little environment is really critical. It's the nursery for baby king salmon. The reds go up to the big lakes to spawn. That's where their fry are being raised. Most of the silvers go up the lake systems, or go up the tributaries, excuse me. That's where their fry, that's where their babies are being raised. Humpies are hatched and out. But the king salmon stay in the main stem of the river. So their protection from the currents, their protection from the sun, their source of food is all that little undercurrent. But when people go fishing on the river, and they do stand in the river to fish, which is awesome, but eventually that backpack gets heavy, or the cooler needs to go somewhere, the pole, you know, they take a break, or they step up out of the water for whatever reason, and there's plenty of them. Again, they're not attempting to do harm. They're having a great time, and that's the intent. That's exciting for them. But there's an unawareness of the critical nature of that bank. And with time, that vegetation dies. It just gets stompled. It gets broken off. You know, just you can see the difference even with a backpack thrown in a bank and left for a few hours. You can see that vegetation is, you know, is crumbled over. But that then is a place that's flatter and more tempting for the next fisherman to come and leave a cooler or whatever, you know, their tackle box. And as I walk the river, I can see so much damage from the hundreds and hundreds of people that come here to fish. And they are careful and they're thoughtful and they're excited, but they don't understand the role of that bank. So what's happening then is now that vegetation has died. And as that vegetation dies and the water action through flooding and rising and sinking waters through the spring and the fall, the ice, there's a huge amount of erosion. And then it starts again. So the protection of that bank is really important, and there's more damage. A lot of folks are being aware of that and seeing that impact. In the 80s, when there was a huge rise in the amount of people fishing the river, there was a big move to put in elevated walkways, and we have a lot of those now, and stairways off of them for that very reason. So that's really helped. But I'm not sure if the number is up. I suspect there's more people fishing, and they're fishing in different places because they're not. Because king fishing, which was always done from boats, isn't the main draw. Now, the main draw are the sockeye salmon. Folks are, you know, flocking to the riverbanks, using often those access points, but also going by boat to places that weren't heavily fished before and have no infrastructure to support where they stand or go. So that would be a big one. And I think, and I'm hoping that that's going to all, you know, that's a matter of education. That's a matter of a lot of people needing to get together and have conversations about steps to take to change that.
I see. Now, I'm curious about, you know, riparian zones. I've been out fishing on the river, and I've seen, you know, a lot of the riparian zones have like sort of like a border where it's closed off for mm-hmm. people to walk on. But I still have seen people walking on it. And, you know, when that happens, I don't really exactly know how to address it to them. So how would you, you know, suggest, hey, you know, maybe you shouldn't be walking there?
Yeah, isn't it awkward? It's tricky, right? I think that some of the things that would help are signs. You know, if there was a sign, you could point to the sign instead of you being the one to say, so, hey, buddy, you know, give them a little speech. I don't really know. I think that it is a hard thing for folks to do. And I really think there are people who would do it anyway. But I think a lot of people, if they knew and understood, but it's also going to take a minute, just like it just took me, you know, to describe and to define that so that they understand what's the problem. Are you just, you know, exaggerating here?
And does the book address riparian zones?
Yeah, it does. It does. There's, you know, that's a portion of the book for sure. But there's an equal portion that is the early arrival. My childhood experiences are woven throughout it, so that's kind of the introduction through each of the different chapters of the experiences I've had with those, learning about those varying cultures or encountering for the first time. And that's, you know, that's a big part of the book as well. And then there's a chapter dedicated to each of the different cultures that I talked about as well.
And, you know, we've talked about elements of the book that sort of make it a warning or a call to action. Are there any other elements that we haven't addressed in regard to that you'd like to talk about?
I think that really covers it. I think, you know, it's been a long time coming and it'll be a long time fix, but I think that there is an elevated and a rising concern and interest for people. And I think there are places that they can learn more about that.
And, you know, how do you balance the two elements of it being sort of a tribute and a call to action, you know, in your writing?
I think it's the tribute that helps to motivate the call for action. I think that as people see and understand the role that it's played through time, that it gains value and perspective in it, and it becomes more than just their river. You know, the river doesn't belong just to us. It's not ours to exploit. It's ours to protect. But it's not just ours. It belongs to, you know, the people who are yet to come too. And what will they encounter? What will they see? One of my dreams is that 500 years from now, people will still fish that river. They'll still see wildlife along its banks. they'll still have the experience and opportunity to see the river as it is, at least as it is now, and have that opportunity to do it. But if things, you know, things could go south too.
And, you know, the blending of those two elements, did that sort of come across naturally, or was that sort of difficult to, you know, put into words?
I mean, that's really powerful and poignant to me. It matters a lot. I think because I've lived it a long time and thought about it a lot, that I was able to work to articulate it and represent it. That is one of the things that I had people read it. Bless those people that read this book in its early stage. And I love you guys. Thank you. And asking for clarity in that regard. I think that, you know, that was really important. I don't want to go overboard in any one way or another, but to accurately represent matters a lot to me.
And you mentioned the people that sort of read the book before it was, you know, published. You know, tell me about that. Was it like friends? Was it like actual editor? Like, I would assume there was an actual, like a you know, professional editor involved, but did you have friends that helped as well?
Oh, I did. I had Shauna Loshbaum, who is a historian and a writer, and she wrote a lot for the newspaper. She's written a ton of stuff, actually. She's a really good writer and an editor. And a historian. So she helped a ton. She read through and not only edited, you know, just the content grammatically and making those kinds of corrections, but she also was able to help because some of the decisions to make is, what do you talk about? Do I talk more about this? Do I eliminate that? How much more do I elaborate on? Is this, you know, those are all tricky decisions. And she helped with that a bit. I did hire a couple of editors. There was Dave Acheson, who is a writer, and he read through it and was so helpful too. Wayne Pishon, who's a friend who lives in Anchorage, who's got a long-standing relationship with the river, he read through mostly from that content. And Ben Meyer, who is one of the scientists of the Watershed Forum, early on, well, he was teaching me the science of salmon and the politics of salmon was probably the hardest for me to write. And to really dig in to get to the accurate information. I spent a lot of time on that. It's not necessarily my favorite topic, but it mattered so much. And he was really beneficial and so versed. And he was able to not only teach me really complex issues and help me to find sources that were, you know, credible. But he probably read it more. He's probably the person who's spent the most time reading it other than me. he really went over it a ton and made a lot of suggestions. My son, Joel, he was able to give more, you know, more complex, more source and content, more helping me to better understand what to elaborate in and what to maybe minimize, that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of people. My daughter-in-law, Jen, is a journalist. She has a journalism's degree. She's married to my son Alex, who's a great writer himself. And those two really helped me a ton with the prologue, and some of those decisions, the title. So there was a lot of people that did. And then I edited it a lot myself, but it's really hard for me to self-edit because I know what I meant, and seeing my own mistakes, I'm just leave a lot of mistakes when I do it for myself. So I hired an editor too, but I've read through here and seen more mistakes. So, you know, that's just Hunter, how it's going to be.
And, you know, the book, it sounds like it was kind of a long time coming writing it. Is that true? Like, how long did it sort of take you to go from idea to being published?
I think it was a lifetime in learning the content and understanding and learning about all that it contains. But the actual writing of the book was just about 4.5 months. It was a lot of time. It was from, I'd get up at 5:30 in the morning and write to like 3 or 4 in the afternoon for 5 to 7 days a week, that whole time, really steady. I took a break or two to travel a bit, but was pretty much at it that whole time. So it took about that long. I don't know if that's a long time or not, but.
If you're just tuning in to the Kenai Conversation, we're chatting with Terry Carter, lifelong Soldotna resident and author of the soon-to-be-released book, Whispers of Water. The book advocates for the protection of the Kenai River through historical and personal experiences. And you mentioned the book is sort of a lifetime of experiences, but I guess, how long have you had the idea to write like a book like yours?
So have only seriously contemplated it the last few years, but I've been told all forever that I should write a book. A lot of those people are listed in the acknowledgments. Parents and kids around campfires hearing stories, or different friends that I've had through, you know, just through life would go, man, you got to write a book. See, there's another chapter. Come on, girl. Yeah. You know, that kind of thing a lot. I've heard that, but I never really took it seriously or really wanted to. It was when I retired from teaching that I felt like that might be the time to do that, that I knew there would be a shift in how my time was invested. And so I retired, and as soon as summer was over, I kicked in August when school started and started writing then.
And can you tell me a little bit more about, I guess, sort of the idea of where this book came from? You mentioned like a lot of people suggested you mm-hmm. should write a book. Can you tell me about that a little more?
Well, I think it's what I've learned about the area, history. So, you know, walking along someplace and being able to tell somebody, like walking through Old Town Kenai and being able to tell them the history of the people who came there. The Russian era is pretty crazy. That's that's fascinating. And there's not a book that you can pick up that really tells you that. Learning about the Danana culture, that is so mesmerizing, how they so effectively thrived in this area for so long. But there's not, again, a book that you can go to the store and buy that can teach you that. There are a few folks that know, but that's, it's difficult to acquire and attain. So as a teacher, I loved to teach it, and I taught it to other teachers. But then when they say, so, you know, where are the resources? It's like, yeah, well, that's tricky. Okay, so there's this archaeological journal, and here's a, you know, and here's some Russian translations. And they were just scattered across this, you know, vast assortment of little bits and pieces. So I really did want to compile it with the intent that the people who did want to know would have a place and a way to better understand the history and the cultures.
And speaking of history, cultures, and environment, you know, when you were a teacher, did you tend to like gravitate towards those subjects more? Or did you like most enjoy teaching those subjects?
I loved teaching it because I mentioned earlier that the majority of the adults that are here are from somewhere else, but the kids are from here. The majority of the kids are from here. And I learned, I kind of innately knew and understood that place plays a really specific and important role in your identity. But as I went through my teaching career, I began to really investigate a sense of place, which is a really important developmental attainment that plays it plays an important role in identity. And to intentionally help people, kids, to understand their place. It's the point of reference that we have, you know, and there's subtle things like the color of light, the shift in the season, the, you know, the change in temperatures. There's subtle things that really resonate more than we realize. It's often when we go away and come back that it's the smell of the air in the spring and, you know, the color of the fall light that we recognize and see again and, you know, are nostalgic about and remember. So I really wanted to, with intent, help to develop their sense of place, help them to see all the different aspects of this place, to understand it, and not only to be eventual advocates of it, but so that they better, you know, understand their sense of belonging and how to interact and live here. And so that was a big motivation too.
I see. Yeah, I definitely have that sense of place for back home. Yeah. Like you mentioned, going home, it's, you know, I don't think about it much when I'm here, but like when I go home, especially if it's like the summertime, that like mid-afternoon rain, it kind of resonates with mm-hmm. you. Like you can time it. Florida rain, 4 p.m. in the afternoon every day. Anyway, another thing that you mentioned is, you know, children and kind of making them, helping them find their sense of place here. Would you say that maybe children who grew up here have a deeper connection to the land here than adults who maybe moved here later in life?
I think that there's a lot of adults who lived here later in life that are really connected. But I think that it resonates in a deeper way with people who this is their place. Some of us are born at home and stay there, and some of us go and find our home. And there's a lot of people that have done that here. You know, they've come here and found home. But the kids who are born here that are super connected to this place, I've talked to a lot of kids, or a lot of the kids in my class have come back and have talked about the impact that it made and the difference that it made and the value that they still have for all of that.
Gotcha. And kind of circling back to the book, and you've alluded to it quite a bit throughout this conversation, but I guess more broadly, why did you choose to write this book?
I think, again, you know, making the information available. I think it's interesting. There's you know, action and drama and intrigue of the Russian fur traders. There's just a lot that that is absolutely fascinating. Again, difficult to learn in any other way. It's not well represented or easy to find. So that was one of the big motivations. But, you know, too, I think that there's, you know, there's an aspect of legacy. I want my children's children's children to know this history. I want my my grandkids to see and to understand, you know, who I am because of how, you know, or partially at least because of how I grew up and those experiences, and to capture that for, you know, for those reasons too.
And, you know, this is your first published book. Yes. I guess just kind of generally, how does that feel?
It was really fun to see it in print because I got real sick of it. I got really sick of it when it came to all of the editing. And here we go again, you know, the 35th time, not really, but coming to the realization that, okay, I got to stop, because every time I would go back to it as I'd read it again, you know, from a different state of mind or a different perspective, I'd want to, you know, rewrite and change. And it just, you know, kind of had to have that line drawn. And, you know, there's just a time to turn the page. Then learning all about publishing, that's a whole other thing, Hunter. Publishing and all the complications of the current transition. So there was a time when it was like, whew, you know, I don't even know if it's good anymore. You know, I don't even know if I like it anymore. But it was fun to see it in print. But it's drawing a lot of interest. There's a lot of people who are reading it. For the first time, I was in a bookstore and somebody had seen it on the counter and they walked by and said, hey, that's a really good book. And I didn't know him. So, you know, it wasn't a former student or it wasn't a friend from the community. And, you know, somebody that, you know, just through my time here that I've come to know. And it was somebody who had encountered it in another way, heard about it from another person. So that was a real aha moment. That was a surprise.
Did you say like, hey, I'm the author of that book?
I did eventually. Yeah. Somebody else actually said it first, but yeah, she figured it out.
Nice. Gotcha. Now, you know, you have a copy of the book here in studio. Would you care to read like an excerpt from it?
Yeah, I would like to do that. So I'm going to read the prologue, which is just kind of a snapshot of the whole book in general.
Sounds good.
Okay. The river remembers. The Kenai River has always spoken, though few have truly listened. It carries the weight of the centuries in its ceaseless current, slipping past spruce, stone, and carving through the mountains and forest, bending and reshaping the land as it has since time began. It tells the legacies of those who have come before, the ones who called this river home, whose lives, sustained by the salmon, were written in the rhythm of the water, their histories carried in the silt, their voices murmuring through the trees. Long before my family arrived, before my father fished these waters and my mother built a home on the banks, others lived by the pool of the river. The riverine Kachemak, salmon people who stayed here 2,000 years unchanged before the world even knew of their existence. They built villages along these banks, and their stone tools and carved oil lamps are buried still beneath the moss. The Dena'ina followed, their winter homes dug deep into the earth, their connection to the river deeper still. Russian fur traders sailed their way into history, seeking their fortunes, while early commercial fishermen built their livelihoods on the bounties of the salmon that surged upriver each summer. Homesteaders staked their claims in cabins of rough-hewn logs, building lives as rugged as the relentless as the seasons. Each left their mark on the Kenai, and yet the river remains. It carries the footprints of the past even as it surges forward, a testament to both the fleeting nature of human endeavor and the enduring power of the land. But it's not untouched. The Kenai bears the weight of change, too many boats churning its surface, too many hands grasping at its bounty without heeding the whispers of warning woven into the currents. And now, the kings are vanishing. Once they returned in great waves, pulsing through the river in the long light of summer, their mighty bodies cutting through the current, silvered flanks flashing beneath the surface. They were the lifeblood of the river, the prize of those who cast their nets and lines, the measure of a season's fortune. Their return marked the heartbeat of the ecosystem, a culture, an economy that thrived in their abundance. But the kings no longer reign as they once did. The great salmon runs have thinned. Their numbers dwindled with each passing year, whispers of their absence stirring unease among those who have lived by their return. Their struggle is the river struggle, a sign carried by the changing current. The river is speaking, warning us that something is unraveling. But even in its loss, there's hope, a chance to listen before it's too late. The kings may yet return in strength if we choose to honor the balance they once knew, and if we're willing to stand for the river that has given us so much. I was a child of this river, born into the wild heart of a land still raw with possibility. It was my teacher, my refuge, my inheritance. I listened to the language of the water. I learned the ways of the salmon. I watched the eagles carve the sky with their flight. I knew the river before it was loved too hard, before the rush of people drowned its quiet voice. And now, as the world presses closer, the Kenai whispers with urgency, remember. Remember the ones who came before. Remember, this river doesn't belong to any one of us, but to all of us who have ever stood on the banks, all who are yet to come. It's not ours to possess. It's ours to protect. And if we listen, truly listen, we might still hear its voice. We might still save what's left. And perhaps, if we're wise, generations from now, another child will explore along the river's edge, gaze at the impossible turquoise of the Kenai, and whisper, as I once did, this is my river.
There you go. Blending elements of, you know, history and bringing a call to action. You know, I'm curious, was that like the first part of the book that you wrote, or was it like the, like after the book in itself was all said and done, that was like the last thing you wrote?
It was by far the last thing I wrote. I think, as I write, I don't even know all that I'm going to say until it's said. I don't even know all that I think until I'm going through it. And it's always at the end that I develop the conclusion. I think there's a lot of crystallization of thought and, clarity of understanding that takes place as I compose. And so, yeah, that came way after. And actually, it was one of my editors who was reading, go, listen, girl, we got to have some kind of summary of what's going down here. And then my daughter-in-law and son were talking prologue with me, and that's when that happened.
Gotcha. And, you know, one thing that stood out to me was your mentioning of kings and, mm-hmm. you know, it's depleting, yeah. You know, stock, for lack of a better words. You know, I guess, how does that sort of make you feel?
I think that that has such a big impact on everybody. I think that, you know, there's changes in kings, not just in this system. You know, the Yukon king diminishing is really, you know, really well known. The Kuskokwim, all of the major rivers really that have king salmon are having issues with it. And it's multifaceted. That's a, you know, that's really an interconnected web. They don't know all of the details, but they do know that, you know, in the open water, in the ocean, they're not staying as long. They're coming back sooner. When Les Anderson caught, you know, in 1985, he caught that 94-pound king, almost 95 pounds. And that biologists believe that king had stayed in the river for 6 years. In the 80s, it was really common for to be, you know, 70, you know, 60 to 80 pounds was not uncommon at all. And those fish were 4 and 5 year fish. Now the fish are coming back from 1 to 3 years. So there's factors that are playing into that. So there's ocean factors for sure. They know that, you know, regardless of what you believe the cause of it is, there's change in temperature. You know, the climate is changing, and that's bound to play some type of a role. But some of the things that people don't think about is hatcheries. Just in, you know, Prince William, well, in Alaska, 1.5 billion fry are released from hatcheries. That's a huge amount of competition for the natural runs that are competing in those same systems. For the amount of food. That could be playing a role that we don't completely understand. We know that there's pressure from trawlers, or, you know, deep sea trawlers that are catching, you know, fish, reporting pretty huge numbers. That's bound to play a role of some kind. The change in the river environment, the damage of the different types of vegetation, the riparian zone, we know that that's an impact. We don't. So there's a lot of unanswered questions, but we know that there's a lot of factors that are coming to play. So not only is their diminished size, they're staying in the river, in the ocean longer, so they're coming back much smaller. There's fewer. So, from the time they recorded it until 2012, there had never been fewer than 33,000 kings coming back. The minimum escapement, as the number started to decline, was put at about 17,000, and it hasn't reached those numbers, and it won't again this year, in a long time. So that's not a sustainable return number of kings coming back. So they're in crisis. There's a lot of people think that it's too late, that it can't be saved, that it's over. But there's still us. There's still some of us there that think it's not. And regardless if it is or not, there's things that we can do now to better understand. And if there's things that can be done, I don't want to be the one that doesn't do them. And I want to be one of the ones that are asking the questions and ready to hear the answer, whether I like it or not, and be willing to make some changes on that. I think that, I talked about the rivers all from Europe to the, the East Coast to the Pacific Northwest, and those, the depletion, we've not changed. It's been the same song, second verse for all of those rivers. We kept the urbanization, the growing sprawl around the rivers. There's, logging, mining, damming, all of those things that have such a huge impact continue to take place. And it would be my dream come true if this was the river that we learned to live with, that this is a river that we learned to love enough to take care of it enough to live with it and not live at a price to it.
Gotcha. And, there's a lot of different factors that come into play here, but I'm curious on your thoughts. How could maybe the average person advocate for the Kings?
I think that if this is a big issue for you, get involved, get educated. There are a lot of different organizations, like I mentioned. All community members are welcome to that Kenai King initiative that's going to take place on October 25th. And your voice matters, your opinion matters. So not only to get educated, but get willing to, to take a stand and to take action. Personal action matters, because that's what collectively makes all the difference.
And just, I guess, more broadly, more generally, what are you hoping that readers sort of take away from your book as a whole?
I hope that they take away a better understanding of this place, that we're not the first and that we're not going to be the last. And that it's a fascinating, deep, and interesting history. And, the people that have come here before have a lot to offer. The Kachemak Bay tradition culture left a completely intact river. The Dena'ina culture left a completely intact river. It's just been in the last 50 years that all of these big changes have happened. I think there's a lot that we can learn from those cultures and their capacity to sustain and protect and there's some of the essence of that is in here. But I hope that people just gain an insight that there's so many people that love the river. I hope they see that they're not alone and that, we're in it together. And regardless of, what your particular take is or what your politics might be, we can all band together and that it's not too late, that there's hope.
And would you say that this book is geared more toward like local Alaskans, or would you say it has a more broad scope?
I think that there's a lot of people from a lot of places that really love this river. And I think that any of those people certainly will. I think that there's a real interest and a love affair with Alaska. There's a lot of intrigue and mystery involved. People have, everywhere you go, I'm sure you hear too, Alaska, cool, I've always wanted to go there. So I think that there's that draw. It's already reaching wider than I thought it would. Initially, I thought that it was, that it was just pretty much our community, maybe spreading a bit into Anchorage, but there's a broader interest and far more interest than I thought that there was going to be.
Like where? I'm curious.
There's just different, it's mostly the Pacific Northwest that, and I think it's because they too relate to this river. Rivers have such an important role in their culture and their community. So there's, some writing competitions and some grant opportunities that people have extended to me that I haven't committed to yet, but I'm looking into.
And I know you mentioned that the book hasn't officially been released yet. Can you tell me about its release date and any maybe book signings or activities related to that?
Mm-hmm. So the official release date is September 8th. But there was a lot of interest and a lot of curiosity, even just a lot of family and friends. So I can pre-order them from my publisher, but it will on September 8th will be released really broadly. So Amazon, Barnes and Noble's, Walmart, Target, a whole bunch of crazy places. And then all of the wholesale distribution places is too. Ingram and some of the wholesale places that bookstores can order them from. That's all the official release date. But again, I've been able to order them early. So I've got River City Books is stocked and the Homer Bookstore, the Kenai Visitor Center, some of the local places that have this book. I'm in the process of planning. I've done several signing events already. I'm in the process of planning a few more. There's one on September 24th. It's a fireside chat at the Kenai River Brewery. So that's the current one. That's the next scheduled one. But there's a few more in the works, so we'll see.
Gotcha. And I'm just curious, any thoughts of writing another book? I know you just put this to rest, but...
Yeah, I'm looking actually at writing a children's version of this book. Originally, I had really, super initially, you know, I wanted to get the information out in a consolidated form. But because I had taught, you know, for so long, and I did find sources that I could hand to an adult, maybe an archaeological record or the translation of a Russian journal, but most of the kids couldn't read that. So I wanted to have it at a kid's version. But as I started to write, I realized that I do not talk or write at a fourth or fifth grade reading level. So that's been a big learning curve. So that's what I'm looking into doing next, actually, is a kid's version of it.
Okay, interesting. You know, Terry, I think we've covered most of the bases here. Do you have any lingering thoughts that you'd like to share?
I just would like to thank all the people that have been so supportive and encouraging, the people who have, you know, bought multiple copies to hand out to friends and neighbors, the folks who have called me on the phone and contacted me that they were so moved. One friend who said, my feelings keep running down my face. I'm having a hard time putting it down, but I'm, you know, really impacted by reading it. You know, the folks that are moved to tears as a result of reading it are reading the parts that I cried writing. There's just a lot of heart and a lot of passion, and we river lovers have that in common. So I'd just like to thank everybody for their encouragement and support, for all the folks that showed up at the Wednesday markets to get signatures and to give hugs. And it's just been more than I expected, and I'm just grateful for the support and encouragement.
And that's all for this episode of the Kenai Conversation. A special thank you to Terry Carter for joining us. You can hear the Kenai Conversation every week on Wednesday at 10 a.m. and Saturday at 5 p.m. here on KDLL. Or you could find it on our website, kdll.org. I'm Hunter Morrison. Thanks for tuning in.